Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by shipping cheap parts around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Skip the tariff and snag yourself American-made clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
This is continuing coverage of United States versus Sean Diddy Combs from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
You don't start a career in hip-hop by babysitting someone's diamonds, dodging threats, and cleaning baby oil off hotel walls. But for Capricorn Clark, that was day one. Her story doesn't begin with a glamorous title or red carpet appearances. It starts with proximity, being close to the flame. And in this case, the flame was Sean Diddy Combs, music mogul, business tycoon, and, if prosecutors are to be believed, the ringleader of an empire built on fear, power, and silence. Clark joined Combs' team in 2004. She wasn't new to the music scene. In fact, she'd done some time working for Death Row Records, the label founded by Suge Knight. If that name rings a bell, it should. Knight and Combs were famously at odds during hip-hop's most dangerous era. So when Clark showed up on Combs' payroll with Suge Knight on her resume, it didn't go over quietly. According to her, Combs made it clear from the jump, if anything happened because of that past, he'd have to kill her. That wasn't delivered as a joke. It wasn't a metaphor. That was the tone setter. Welcome to the team. Despite that charming welcome, Clark settled into her role. She started as Combs' personal assistant, handling the kind of responsibilities that went far beyond calendar invites. We're talking travel prep, wardrobe management, last-minute errands, drug runs. Her job essentially was to make the chaos look seamless. Over time, she climbed the internal ranks, eventually moving into creative direction for Combs' then-girlfriend, Cassie Ventura. But no matter how high she moved, she never really escaped the gravitational pull of Diddy's control. And that control wasn't subtle. One of the earliest incidents Clark testified about involved some loaned jewelry, high-end pieces borrowed for one of Combs' events. When the jewelry went missing, Clark didn't get a performance review. She got locked in a room and strapped to a polygraph machine for 5 straight days. According to her, it happened in a vacant office building. Every day, a large man administered lie detector tests, grilling her about the jewelry. And every day, he allegedly reminded her, "Fail this test and they'll throw you in the East River." Just a casual threat of murder to liven up the work week. No evidence she stole anything. No charges, just psychological warfare over accessories. That set the tone for the culture Clark says she operated in, one built on intimidation, where fear was the currency and loyalty was enforced, not earned. She stayed because, like many people inside systems like this, leaving wasn't as simple as quitting a job. It was her livelihood, her network, and in a lot of ways, her identity. Still, even Clark had limits. Around 2006, she and Combs had a blow-up while working in Miami. She had been living out of his house for weeks on end, doing round-the-clock work, and at some point, she voiced frustration, told him she wanted a life of her own. Combs didn't take it well. According to her, he screamed at her to get back inside and told her, "Your problem is you want a life. You can't have that here." He allegedly shoved her during the confrontation, and that was it. Clark quit, at least for a while. But leaving Combs' world didn't always stick. Eventually, she came back. Not directly to him at first, but through Cassie Ventura, who requested Clark return to serve as her creative director. It was a job she hoped would give her distance from Combs himself, even if the orbit remained the same. In this new role, she was helping Cassie develop music, refine her image, and launch her brand. It looked different on paper, but the infrastructure hadn't changed. Combs still loomed over everything. Every decision passed through him. Cassie may have had more voice by then, more bravado, as Clark put it, but she was still inside the same machine. And Clark, even after everything, kept re-engaging with it. Her loyalty to Cassie seemed genuine. She described Cassie as sweet and talented, but increasingly affected by the environment. "Combs," she said, began stepping back slightly, letting Cassie make more of her own choices, but only up to a point. The leash was never off. And when Cassie eventually walked away from the relationship and the business in 2018, Clark's professional ties to the empire came to an end too, at least temporarily. Because in 2024, after Combs' homes were raided by federal agents and the full scale of the investigation became public, Clark met with Combs' lawyers. She didn't go to sue him. She didn't show up to give a deposition. She went to talk about a job, a high-level one. She wanted to be his chief of staff. That part made headlines when it came up in court. The defense used it to paint her as inconsistent. If things were really so bad, they argued, why would she ever want back in? Clark's answer was complicated. She said she missed the work. She believed she was good at it. And in some strange way, she thought she could navigate the chaos this time, maybe even keep it in check. It's not the kind of answer that fits neatly into a courtroom narrative. But that's the thing about abusive power structures. The longer you live inside one, the more normal it feels. The dysfunction gets repackaged as challenge. The fear gets mistaken for loyalty. Somewhere in that tangle of survival, trauma, and ambition is the real story of Capricorn Clark, a woman who, for years, helped orchestrate the chaos around Sean Combs while trying to maintain a career inside a system that seemed engineered to break people. She endured threats, physical intimidation, coercion, and still, she stayed. Not because she was naive, not because she didn't understand the danger, but because sometimes the line between professional and personal doesn't just blur. It vanishes. By the time December 2011 rolled around, Clark was no longer just an assistant or a creative lead. She was a witness, and that month, the pressure that had been simmering for years between Combs, Cassie, and a man named Scott Mascuti, better known as Kid Cudi, finally boiled over. It started before the sun came up, December 22, 2011. Capricorn Clark had no reason to expect anything unusual from that morning until Sean Combs allegedly began pounding on her apartment door. It was early, somewhere around 5:30 or 6 a.m. According to Clark, he didn't knock like a man with a question. He knocked like a man with an agenda. And when she opened the door, there he was, furious, partially disheveled, and by her account, holding a gun. This wasn't some vague threat from across the room. Clark testified that Combs stood in her doorway, armed with his pants torn open at the seam and his rage boiling over. He was yelling about Cassie Ventura, more specifically, about Cassie seeing another man, rapper Scott Mascuti, better known to the world as Kid Cudi. Combs, by Clark's account, was in full emotional collapse, allegedly demanding answers and declaring that someone was going to pay, and that someone, he said, was Cudi. The order was direct: get dressed, we're going to go kill him. Not discuss, not confront, kill. Clark said she was terrified. According to her testimony, she told Combs she didn't want to go. He didn't care. He made it clear that her preferences were irrelevant. The plan was already in motion, and she was part of it, whether she liked it or not. Clark said she felt trapped, completely powerless to resist, so she got dressed. Combs ushered her into a black Cadillac Escalade along with one of his bodyguards. And the ride began. Clark recalled the details vividly. Combs, sitting in the back with her, the gun resting on his lap, his demeanor seething and silent. The SUV climbed into the hills toward Kid Cudi's residence. The drive, she said, took about 15 to 20 minutes, long enough for the reality of what might happen to sink in, not long enough to plan an escape. She was, by her account, now part of something criminal, terrifying, and entirely beyond her control, but Clark wasn't completely out of options. As the car approached Cudi's home, she reached for the one thing she still had, a burner phone. Cassie had given it to her specifically for moments like this when she couldn't risk being overheard or tracked. Clark used it to call Cassie and warn her. She didn't speak in code. She didn't hold back. She told her straight, "Puff got me with a gun and brought me to Cudi's house to kill him." In the background, Clark could hear Cudi's voice and what he reportedly said right then, was chilling. He's in my house? That phone call set off a chain reaction. Cootie, hearing that Combs had entered his home, immediately rushed back. Cassie, realizing the gravity of the situation, was panicking. Meanwhile, Clark sat helpless in the SUV, hoping the call was enough to stop something irreversible from happening. Inside the house, Combs and the bodyguard didn't find Cootie. He wasn't home at the time. But when Clark's call was discovered, when Combs realized she had warned Cassie, his fury turned on her. According to Clark, he grabbed the phone, dialed back the last number, and found himself speaking directly to Cassie. He allegedly screamed at her, and then turned back to Clark, now even more enraged. He told her she wasn't going anywhere unless Cassie came to them. "I won't release you until Ventura comes," she recalled him saying. Cassie agreed. Not because she wanted to, but because it seemed to be the only way to protect Clark. She left the hotel she was hiding in and came to meet them. That decision may have saved Clark, but it came at a cost. Now, Clark described what happened next as one of the most traumatic moments she ever witnessed. Back at Combs' home, after the group had returned, Cassie arrived. Clark said that as soon as Cassie walked through the door, Combs attacked her. There was no argument, no pretense. He allegedly launched into her with a barrage of kicks. According to Clark, Cassie dropped to the floor, curled into a fetal position, and cried silently while Combs kept kicking over and over, not with his fists, not with slaps, with his feet. Clark said she had never seen anything like it. The scene was so brutal, so calculated, that even she, after years of working under Combs, was stunned. What made it worse, she said, was that no one did anything to stop it. Combs' security was present. They watched. They didn't intervene. Clark, desperate to do something, reached out again, but not to the police, not directly. Instead, she called Cassie's mother. The words she used in that call were later repeated in court. "He's beating the S out of your daughter. I can't call the police, but you can." She was pleading for someone, anyone, to step in, because doing so herself felt impossible. The environment around Combs didn't just tolerate violence, as according to Clark, it protected it. The beating eventually stopped. Cassie survived, but what followed was its own kind of punishment, one rooted not in violence, but in silence. Clark, hoping to report what happened, went to the Human Resources Department at Bad Boy and to Harve Pierre, a senior executive. She told them everything, the kidnapping, the threats, the attack on Cassie. Their response was muted at best. According to Clark, Pierre's reaction was simply, "That's crazy, but it's going to be okay." It wasn't. Soon after, Clark was fired. The reason listed wasn't for breaking protocol or disobeying orders. It was for improper vacation day logging. That was the official line. But Clark believed it was retaliation for speaking up, and whether that's provable in court or not, it's worth noting that she filed a wrongful termination suit after her dismissal. The case never went to trial. It was settled quietly, with the terms undisclosed. That moment, being removed from the company after reporting violence, became the inflection point. Clark, once a trusted insider, was now on the outside. No longer just an assistant. No longer part of the team. She was a liability. And years later, when the federal case against Sean Combs began to take shape, Clark returned, this time not with a schedule or a travel itinerary, but with testimony. Testimony about a gun, a car ride, a violent ambush, and a woman being brutalized while others stood by. Her story wasn't just dramatic, it was forensic, and in the eyes of prosecutors, it was foundational. Because if you believe her, then this wasn't about a relationship gone bad. It wasn't about celebrity temper tantrums or egos colliding. It was about something much darker, a system. One where silence was mandatory, loyalty was weaponized, and violence was a tool, not a glitch. And in the weeks that followed, the courtroom would hear more stories, some that mirrored Clark's, some that filled in different parts of the puzzle. But on that day, with that testimony, Capricorn Clark stopped being part of the machine. She became the witness.
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, How to Best Kill Somebody with a Knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.